Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. She will be back with us on Monday. But today we're going to be talking with the Goodmans, Amy Goodman and David Goodman, the brother and sister investigative team. And their third book is called Standing Up to the Madness. Not only is it a timely, inspiring, and even revolutionary look at who wields the greatest power in America, everyday people who take a chance and stand up for what they believe in, but also offers advice on what you can do to help. The award-winning sister-brother team of Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, and investigative journalist David Goodman traveled the country to detail the ways in which grassroots activists have taken politics out of the hands of politicians. We have David Goodman on the line with us, and I believe you're in Dallas this morning.
This morning, yes. Well, we are in Houston, right state.
All right, you're in Houston, and you're on this madcap dash across the country to promote this book.
Well, it is we're crisscrossing the country, and this book partly arises out of previous book tours where we've traveled around the country and met many of these grassroots activists, and finally decided, you know, this really needs to be captured in a book. Just what is the kind of grassroots uprising really that we see from coast to coast in communities everywhere.
Well, you and your sister work better than many family members are able to collaborate on things. Your first book is 2004, The Exception to the Rulers, Exposing Oily Politicians, War Profiteers, and the Media That Loves Them. Give us a little synopsis of that book.
Well, The Exception to the Rulers really focused very much on the role that the media has played and was playing. The book that came out in 2004, in the whole run-up to the war, how the mainstream media acted as a conveyor belt for the lies of the Bush administration that led us into a war that was based on those lies. So, even as we were writing that book, which was during the whole start of the Iraq War, it was quite apparent the kind of propaganda campaign that had been mounted to sell this war to the public. So the idea that, we only know now in 2008 what was going on, we knew then what was going on, where we had, hundreds of channels, but all with the same point of view. And I think that was, so we were really looking at the variety of ways that, in real time, we had been sold a bill of goods with just absolutely catastrophic consequences, as we now know.
Talking with David Goodman, and you and Amy came up with a second book 2 years later, Static Government Liars, Media Cheerleaders, and People Who Fight Back. So you've added a degree to this with the people who fight back.
That's right. And I just want to check that that you've been able to get Amy on the line, too. So that we're both able to speak to this.
I don't have Amy's listing yet. Amy is there? All right.
I'm here.
And there you are, Amy. It's a pleasure to talk to you today.
It's great to be joining you as well. The second book, I think, follows in line is right and coming before Standing Up to the Madness. The reason we called it Static is because here we live in a high-tech digital age with high-definition television and digital radio, and yet still all we get is static, a veil of distortion and lies and misrepresentations and half-truths that obscure reality, when what we need the media to give us is a dictionary definition of static, criticism, opposition, unwanted interference. We need a media that covers power, not covers for power, a media that is the fourth estate, not for the state, and a media that covers the movements that create static and make history. So we, on the one hand, fiercely critique the corporate media, but we also recognize the hope in this country, and that is independent media all over this country, and it has to be protected. We have to grow it. I mean, Wisconsin Public Radio is a part of that. WORT in Madison is a part of that. Pacifica Radio, public television as well. The many places that Democracy Now! Also broadcasts on television and radio. These are sacred national treasures, the public airwaves that we all must protect. And by the way, I just wanted to give a shout out to Catherine and say I wish her the very best and look forward to hearing her on the radio next week.
Yes, likewise.
Sounds good. We're talking with Amy Goodman and David Goodman, the brother and sister team who have now put out Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times. Amy, the host of Democracy Now!, David, investigative reporter, author. Frequently you'll read him in Mother Jones, although I notice in the current issue, the new issue, you're not there. I suspect it's because you're so involved in promoting this book.
I have a new piece on the website. Yes, the book has taken pretty much all our oxygen in recent months.
If you'd like to join this conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. You've dedicated the book to your extraordinary mother, as you call her, Dory Goodman. Talk about her.
Well, our mom, in addition to being an amazing mother, has really been a role model, as was our late dad. And, you know, it's interesting you should raise this. People often will ask us at our book events, one of which is coming up on the 28th in Minneapolis, that I think is within your listener area.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was our family like? And I guess I would say our parents were both very active in community affairs, and our dad was involved in the early 70s. He led a task force to integrate our local schools that we were attending, and both were, he was also a founder of the Long Island chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility. In many ways, these weren't seen as something out of the ordinary. We would talk about the issues of the day around the table, just along with passing the salad and fighting over, you know, who had to do what chores afterward. But, you know, being active in the community and active in national issues or aware of them was always a part of our growing up. I also had a little newspaper called Dave's Press, which really chronicled our family's goings-on. It was I would mail it to relatives. Amy and my older brother were both involved in producing this, frantically Xeroxing these things, always after deadline. But it included everything from reporting to the family, you know, when Amy had been grounded for some offense, to the Vietnam War, which I held forth about as a very opinionated 9- and 10-year-old, and we would get irate
letters
from uncles.
And our great-uncles and grandfather would weigh in, and David would argue with them on the letters to the editor page. So we definitely saw journalism as a place to have that global conversation. Now the forum has just gotten a little larger.
It certainly has. At the end of your broadcast, Amy, I hear you go off on a list of a number of venues where Democracy Now! Can be heard, and it's in the several hundreds.
Right. Well, we're talking 700 radio and television stations around the country now, on Pacifica and NPR and PBS and Public Access and the two TV satellite networks, the independent channels, Free Speech TV and Link TV. And it's growing every week. I really just think that there is a hunger for independent voices in this country. The voices that you hear on Democracy Now!, like the soldiers who participated in the Winter Soldier hearing a few weeks ago in Silver Spring, Maryland at the National Labor College, a remarkable gathering of active duty and Iraq and Afghanistan veterans who've come back to talk about their experiences of war. The corporate media hardly covered it, but on public radio and Democracy Now! You could hear it. And it's the same voices we chronicle in standing up to the madness. I mean, people who in ordinary times might not stand out, but when confronted with a very serious issue, like, well, librarians in Connecticut, who the FBI came to, handed them an NSL, a national security letter, and tells them that they must hand over information about their patrons who uses the internet, and if they don't, they could go to jail, and they absolutely cannot mention this to anyone, not their wives, not their kids, not their coworkers, just librarians, hit with something they never dreamed they'd be hit with, and then deciding to stand up against
George
the U.S.
Christian,
government.
I believe, huh? George Christian.
Right. He was one of the four librarians in Connecticut who was served with this NSL. And, you know, when we debate the Patriot Act and talk about it in the abstract, it can seem like a very arcane piece of legislation. When it reaches out and touches you, it's a very different matter. It is an extremely, really terrifying assertion of the government's power over individuals. These are letters that can be given by just an FBI agent with no judge's oversight. So essentially, a street corner cop, an FBI agent is basically a federal version of a street corner cop, but that's it. An FBI agent is suspicious about something, can issue an NSL. You are, upon opening this, it's like being exposed to radioactivity. You can suddenly, you are gagged from speaking to anyone. You are bound by its provision upon pain of going to a 5-year jail sentence. And we learned from these librarians who had this happen to them, because the FBI was interested in one email sent from one computer at one of 28 libraries in central Connecticut. They didn't have to say why they thought this email was suspicious, just that they were interested. So on that basis, they wanted out the names of everyone who had been in any one of these 28 libraries on a particular day. The librarians said, in greeting the FBI agents who came to the library, said, "We feel this is unconstitutional." And they said, "We will not give you this information." And thus began this really Orwellian odyssey. And in fact, we asked one of the librarians, which book on your shelves best captures what you've been through? And they said, both librarians we were talking to at that moment said, well, it's 1984.
Yeah.
They couldn't speak about it, and they couldn't tell anyone about it, as Amy said. It turns out that these NSLs, far from being something reserved for the worst hardened terrorists, have been given to, we now know, at least 150,000 people just between 2003 and 2005. So virtually people in communities all across the country are under investigation, but they can't even tell you about it.
So you have to realize here there was a very active debate over the USA Patriot Act in Congress, and you had John Ashcroft saying that librarians were not getting these NSLs, these national security letters. But these librarians were not allowed to say they were, on pain of going to prison for years. These were the very librarians who were standing up for academic freedom, freedom of speech. They were heads of these intellectual freedom committees in their local organizations. They were the ones who would speak out, and suddenly they had to go mum. So when a newspaper would call and get the attorney general or the U.S. attorney's position, he was free to speak. And then they would try to reach the spokesperson for the libraries on this issue, and he couldn't return their call.
It's an extraordinary story. It's one of 15 sort of episodes that you outline in the book. The book, of course, is called Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes at Extraordinary Times, written by Amy and David Goodman, published by Hyperion just out this month, their third book. And we will take your calls and questions and comments in just a moment. I'm Jim Packard. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, let's take some calls, and we will start off with Patrick in Richland Center. And Patrick, what's on your mind today?
Well, good morning, Jim. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to ask the two authors there, in all these books you've written and telling everybody what the great media is, what you should listen to reinforce that we all know it's broke, do you spend any time at all, and I hope to keep this short and let me have a follow-up, do you spend any time at all telling the citizens of this country how accessible the power apparatus is to make change, particularly at the state and local level? And I'll give you a couple of examples. When a state senator shows up or somebody like that, instead of asking to have your picture taken with them, okay, then you ask them about particular legislation.
Such
a good example, in Madison, Mark Miller has got great legislation originally introduced by Russ Feingold to fix the health care situation in Wisconsin. He won't even agree to have a hearing on his own legislation. Ask him that kind of, we just had a standoff here with the cops to get one 60-year-old man, and they had like 34 agencies involved to get him out for not paying a few bucks in property taxes. I'll be attending the next law enforcement committee meeting to ask the sheriff some questions that nobody else will. And when you attend these committee meetings, call the local media first. A lot of times they'll come and take notes for you, because people, you got to ask these, regardless of their Democrat or Republican, they're your public servant.
I mean, you are raising such an important point. This is a key year, a pivotal year, perhaps the most important year in years, if not in a century. It is the year that the leadership of this country will be determined. At the highest level, the President of the United States. a while ago, I interviewed a woman from Guyana about globalization. I was done with her. We were then going to have a section on U.S. politics on the U.S. presidential campaign, and she said, I'll be participating in that. I said, actually, we will be done with your segment then. She said, no, I want to be there for that discussion. I said, why? You're from Guyana. And she said, because I believe everyone in the world should get to vote for president of the United States. That is such a profound point. Now, they don't get to, but we do. And what you do this year matters, could determine the fate of the earth. I'm not telling you who to vote for, but to be active is key. And to address your point, you're right. It's not just for president. It's getting active at every level, because often it starts at the lowest levels, or not lowest, but most local levels, being involved in your school board and your library board and your city council, your town meeting, going up to the state legislature. And when everyday people who deeply care about their community start getting elected to those positions, you will have politicians at the highest level that you can deeply believe in and feel proud about voting for. You're making a critical point.
Patrick, if you have a question, make it quick, because we've got a lot of callers stacked up.
Okay, Amy, the thing of it is, you went to a lady in Guyana. I'm talking about right here.
No, I know. I was just making a point. And that's what Democracy Now! Does. And every community, bringing out the voices at the grassroots, who are challenging those in power and trying to improve their communities. You're absolutely correct in that issue of photo apps. Is so important. I mean, instead of getting you can have someone take a picture of you while you're making your point to a politician. And don't let these presidential campaign visits just be a chance for them to grandstand. Make demands. You are the ones who will determine whether they are elected or not. Don't just let you be a photo app for them to come whip through town, count how many people are in the arena, and move on to the next either campaign finance stop or photo op. Make it substantial.
Yeah, well, Amy, to say your opinion, you got to ask about particular legislation.
You ask,
why haven't you signed this health care bill? You sit here and tell us that you're concerned about health care.
Patrick, we understand your concern and we understand your point, but I do have to move on. And the next caller is going to be Matt in Green Bay. Hi, Matt.
Hi, great work, guys. We do need going back to your point at the very beginning of the hour, independent media. There's been so much fragmentation of our media from, oh my God, you've got it from every source now. Jump on the internet, you can find anything justifying any opinion on any side of any issue, which makes it very difficult for the common guy out there to sort through all this chaff to get to a real story, to get to the real truth. You can read an article on one issue, and you could look it up on Google or wherever and get the exact opposite opinion with stats and figures and facts, where everything's become so diluted. You don't know what's real.
No, you're right. I mean, we need good journalism. It is not a matter of opinion whether Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Someone can say, I think he did. Someone could say, I think he didn't. And then you move on from there. We have a responsibility as journalists. There is a reason why our profession is the only one explicitly protected by the U.S. Constitution. We're supposed to be the check and balance on government. That's essential to the functioning of a democratic society. So in the lead up to the invasion, when you had President Bush putting forth the idea that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, it is not the role of the media to simply act as a conveyor belt for this false, for this misinformation, for this lie. It is up to the media to investigate. And the fact is, there were many in the highest levels of government, intelligence, in the military, who are saying the evidence doesn't add up. But what was the media doing? In the four nightly newscasts in the lead-up to the invasion, 2 weeks around Colin Powell giving that push for war at the UN, February 5th, 2003, Fairness and Action Reporting did a study of four major nightly newscasts, ABC, NBC, CBS, and the PBS NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. There were 393 interviews done around war. Only three were with anti-war leaders, three of almost 400. That's no longer a mainstream media. That is an extreme media beating the drums for war. Bush could not have convinced the American people there were WMD if he just had a megaphone standing on the steps of the White House. He had something much more powerful. Unfortunately, he had the U.S. media, more powerful than any bomb, more powerful than any missile. And the Pentagon has deployed the media, and we have to take it back. It's not good for the generals. It's not good for the low-level soldiers. It's not good for a democratic society. We have to unembed the media now.
Thanks very much for your call, Matt. We appreciate hearing from you. Our guests are Amy and David Goodman. They are the authors of Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with David and Amy Goodman about their book, Standing Up to the Madness. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. That, of course, is a toll-free call. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And let's take another call from Joan in Clear Lake. Hello, Joan. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm very nervous. Amy, you are my hero. I never miss your show. And my cats, I tell them the Amy show is on, they come and pet you on television. David, I'm not so familiar with you, but you two are just, I don't know what I'd do without you two. And my question is, where and how do you find your courage and strength to provide us with the truth?
Well, I think it comes from, well, the subtitle of our book, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times. It comes from the people that we interview all over this country and around the world, people who are resisting, who are fighting back. They may be protesting in the streets, but they may well not be. We talk about the librarians who decided to stand up for everyone when told they were gagged, that they were not allowed to speak out, and they became the freedom fighters of our time, protecting our privacy. Then you've got the scientists, the climatologists, like the well-known scientist of NASA, James Hansen, who finds all of a sudden that his work is being censored, that the words global warming are being vacuumed off government websites by the very government that we elect. There are the psychologists, the members of the APA, the American Psychological Association, who, unlike the American Psychiatric Association, American Medical Association, which bans their members from participating in coercive interrogations, the APA, the largest psychologist association in the world, refuse to ban psychologist participation in places like Guantanamo and Bagram and Abu Ghraib and other CIA black sites. And so what happened then was that psychologists started to stand up, lead a movement within the Psychological Association to say we have to ban members' participation. We cannot condone torture. This has been a several-year movement. It was first just a core of folks who set up this coalition for ethical psychology. Now many members are withholding their dues. A number are resigning, and the leading dissident, a psychoanalyst in New York named Dr. Reisner, is now running for president of the APA, and he received the most nominations for his presidential bid. In October, he will be running against a number of other candidates, and we will find out who wins the APA presidency about the same time we decide the presidency of the United States. And let's hope torture is a central point in both debates and elections. That's an issue I wrote about, and I also do, in addition to Democracy Now! And democracynow.org, a weekly column. I know a number of Wisconsin newspapers run it. You can ask your local newspaper to do it. But we take on these issues, bringing out the voices of the grassroots, people who are working in their communities despite ridicule, despite being ignored by the mainstream media at the beginning. They persist. And it goes to our opening quote that is often attributed to Mahatma Gandhi. First they ignore you. Then they laugh at you. Next they fight you. Then you win.
Joan, thank you for your call. We appreciate hearing from you as we talk with David and Amy Goodman. David, we don't want to keep you out of the conversation.
I'm listening attentively. My sister's doing a fine job with answering questions, the questions that have come in. But
And not all of these stories that you put in here are contemporary stories. You lead off with some fascinating information that I did not know about Rosa Parks.
Well, that's right. We have throughout the story, I mean, as we talk about today's ordinary heroes, we wanted to bring back and maybe shed a little new light on some of the older past actions of great courage and
where people have stood up and made a difference, and that Gandhi quote about, you know, at first being ignored and then winning, I think has been a hallmark of many of these. So one of those stories is the story of Rosa Parks, a story that all of us are familiar with. We learn about it in school. But there's a part of the story that doesn't get told, and that is the part where, you know, when she passed away a couple years ago, she was eulogized as just a simple seamstress, no troublemaker, who was just too tired to give up her seat on a segregated public bus. But the media really got it wrong. The truth was that Rosa Parks was an activist who, by experience, training, and choice, was a first-class troublemaker. She grew out of movement activism and came to be really a very powerful inspiration to that movement. But, you know, her husband, she and her husband Raymond, were both members of the NAACP. They raised money to help defend the Scottsboro Boys, a group of nine black teenagers who were falsely accused and convicted of raping two white women in Alabama in 1931. Rosa Parks was the secretary to E.D. Nixon, who was a veteran civil rights campaigner and also a legendary union leader of the Pullman Porters Union. And she attended the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee, which is a leadership training and education center for workers' rights and racial equality. So that really, to put Rosa Parks in that context, you know, Studs Terkel was talking, Amy was interviewing him on Democracy Now!, and when he speaks about Rosa Parks, what he says, and we quote him, he says, Rosa Parks did not come out of a vacuum, and he speaks about her association with these movements and organizations, and he said, all this played a role in her one day refusing to stand up. It was never one person. Remember that. It's a combination of many people, many forces, and you know, that is the point of our book. We're not pulling people out of a crowd. We're, in fact, wanting to be sure that people understand that these are part of communities and part of movements. You know, very often people, when they stand up, they are just one person, and that first step is frightening. You wonder, when you take the first step, will anyone follow you? But often you come to find out that people have been ruminating, organizing, and you know, thinking about taking action on issues ranging from, you know, protecting civil liberties under threats from the Patriot Act to global warming. You know, when Jim Hansen, the NASA scientist, first stood up, he too had to wonder as the government began attacking him for saying that there was global warming. The Bush administration in particular has been zealously trying to muzzle its top scientist. But when Hansen stood up an entire environmental movement to stop global warming stepped in behind him, and I think both feed each other, and so that people should know that they will not be alone when they take these courageous steps.
I mean, on the point of the global scientists, we wrote a chapter in Standing Up to the Madness called Some Don't Like It Hot, and we talked about how in early February 2006, unbeknownst to most of NASA's 19,000 employees, NASA's mission statement was quietly changed. It originally was to understand and protect our home planet, to explore the universe and search for life, to inspire the next generation of explorers as only NASA can. Well, the phrase to understand and protect our home planet disappeared. Instead, the mission became to pioneer the future in space exploration, scientific discovery, and aeronautics research. So Star Trek was in, and planet Earth was toast. It's documenting what happens, and when you sense in your workplace or in your organization some kind of gradual change or maybe precipitous change, or you're confronted with something individually, you have to decide what to do. And that's what you document, like a class of high school kids in Wilton, Connecticut, who are just doing their normal annual play, and they decided to take on the issue of war, quoting soldiers and active duty soldiers and veterans who had written letters home, and they pieced that together in a play. No big deal, until their principal came and said they could prepare for the play, they could practice it, they could make the costumes for it. They just couldn't perform it because it was too controversial. The kids fought back. They said, why not? And he said, that ship has sailed. and that sailed them right onto the New York stage, because when big theaters heard about the censorship, they invited the kids to perform in New York, where actors their whole lives dream of performing. So suddenly they're performing in front of hundreds of theatergoers night after night. It was an amazing story and really empowered the kids and the teacher who led them, even though she was put under tremendous pressure, threatened with firing if she moved forward and dared to take these kids to New York. She said, no, this is an important lesson that has to be stood up for, and the kids and their parents stood up as well. That section is called Voices in Conflict, and it's remarkable to see when people stand together.
We're talking with Amy Goodman, the host and executive producer of Democracy Now!, and her brother David Goodman, investigative journalist. Together they've written Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard with my guests Amy and David Goodman, and a couple of emails that we would like to find out about. Someone, Al in Milwaukee, is wondering about our surveillance television future, the surveillance of people from polls all over the cities. He notices it in London, but wonders about the future here in the United States, and he apparently is not looking around because there are cameras everywhere.
Well, I think these are, these are issues. I mean, when these kinds of civil liberties intrusions occur, they have to occur by, local police departments or perhaps federal police departments, but these are entities that are accountable to us. And it may go unnoticed and unchallenged until the first person, such as this person who's emailed in, takes notice and asks that first question. These are things that need to be brought up in community forums. They need to be brought up to local politicians, and let there be a discussion. How is the information being used, and is that acceptable to the local community?
You know, David had an interesting experience. As you pointed out, we're traveling around the country in a many-city tour, as we often do. We're going to be in Minneapolis, for example, on April 28th over at the St. Joan of Arc Church. And I was in New Orleans, and then we flew up to Greenfest in Seattle. And David had a very interesting experience hopping into a cab.
Right, that's right. I was getting off the plane in Seattle, and always looking for ways to save money, I jumped into a cab into downtown to Seattle from the airport to share the cab fare with somebody. He was a little surprised, but in the end quite, happy to have a fellow traveler. So we're riding into town, and I said, "What do you do?" And he says, "Well, I'm a defense contractor." And I said, "Oh, and doing what?" He said, "Well, I'm in the surveillance business. I work for a British firm, and we make cameras and wiretapping devices and this kind of stuff." And I said, "Well, how's business?" And he said, "It's never been better." But then the conversation got interesting. I asked him what he was doing on this continent. He had been in Ottawa at a conference, sometimes referred to as an arms bazaar. Actually, as he said, the protesters outside were protesting the merchants of death and the arms bazaars, and he was sort of ruining this fact that he was being cast this way. But he said, I asked him, what do you do at these conferences? He says, "Well, we were getting all these briefings about the rising threat of terrorism and the new tactics that terrorists are taking and new countermeasures and new technologies that could be used." And I said, "Do you believe that stuff?" And he looked at me and smiled. He said, "It's pure rubbish." He said, "I don't believe any of it." And he said, "I think a lot of people are using this to make a lot of money and to get politicians are using it to get things passed that they couldn't ordinarily get passed." And so this was, I thought he'd read our book already. But in fact, this was just his, very kind of hard-bitten view of this. He was quite cynical of the whole thing. And he said, "I don't think really much has changed in the world of terrorist threats, other than that we're talking about it more now." He said, "There's always been a pretty steady business in these issues, and now it's just been used to political advantage."
All right, let's go to the phones, take some more calls. And Steve in Middleton, let's give you a chance. Go ahead.
Continuing along that line, David, I'm wondering why you as an investigative journalist and the Democracy Now! Program never really go into what really happened on September 11th. Is that out of bounds because of your Ford Foundation funding? Here are the two tall 110-story buildings were pulverized in 8 seconds. Everybody reported hearing multiple explosives going off. And yet, talk about standing up to the madness. We've seen no attempt to interview people like Webster Tarpley or David Ray Griffin. I really want to know, and now the military commissions down in Guantanamo are doing a frame-up job on a few captives, blaming them for 9/11, and there's still no coverage over this. So, you know, we all love you guys, and you're all so pure and great, but I wonder, is 9/11 out of bounds, and why are you embedded in the Pentagon official story for that atrocity? And what about building number 7? Why don't you speak truth to power? Thank you.
You know, on the issue of David Ray Griffin, we did have him on Democracy Now!, and I do think that the 9/11 Commission did not do an adequate job, and that does need to be fully investigated.
And let's go to Leah in Milwaukee next. Hello, Leah.
Hi. My question is, I guess it's twofold. First of all, I was wondering how much in your book, I know you just mentioned the high school students, but more college students and kind of what we can do better to get involved. I know, especially Facebook and everything, everybody is really involved in the presidential campaign. But I feel like talking to a lot of my fellow college students that a lot of us kind of feel almost disembodied as the American people. What I mean by that is when you see President Bush addressing Congress saying that the American people want this and he's going to veto a bill that Congress is putting through and Congress needs to put their act together. And I feel like a lot of this political debate and what's happening in our legislative area is just, it's so set apart from us that we actually elected Congress and that we actually elected our local officials. So to veto something means that you're saying no to the American people and what they want. And I feel like talking to a lot of my fellow students, that kind of just makes you feel like, well, there's nothing I can do about it. Nothing's going to happen, so why should I worry about it? Why should I even, I'm just going to go on and get my degree and try to get a career. And I was wondering how much you found about that when you were going through the country, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, Leah.
Well, I think that, the moment you you raise your voice on an issue that matters to you, you break through that sense of disempowerment that you're speaking about. I think that college students have made an enormous difference. I mean, certainly in the presidential campaign, you are among the most coveted voter groups that the lead candidates are trying to woo. And that is for a reason, and that's because you're not only voting now, some of you for the first time, but you've got 60-some years of voting ahead of you. And I think that, in our book, we have a whole section on students who stand up, from these high school students that Amy mentioned who put on a play quoting soldiers and just their words, soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan and the realities of war. We also traveled to Gina, Louisiana, and many people, of course, have heard of the story of the Gina Six. But being in Gina and understanding how young people confronted this dual system of justice that exists all over the country, where blacks and Latinos are given, are railroaded right from schoolhouse to jailhouse, and how this is now a whole movement to try and address the criminalization of school discipline that has gone on. Really, some just shocking statistics about how, rather than being sent to the principal, students are now being sent to the police for routine school issues. So I do think that you should not underestimate how important the voices of students are to people in power. There is no politician that you will encounter, whether it's your local state representative on up, who will not take seriously some college students showing up with concerns, because that person knows that you have access to something
that he or she does not have access to, which is the ability, you know, just through postering around your college campus, mobilizing, you know, potentially thousands of voters. So voter registration drives that take place at college, continuing to talk to students. And, you know, sometimes you may not see the results this week. You know, you may have a meeting of a college, a peace group, for example. Maybe you didn't get the turnout you wanted, but being a few years out of college, I can tell you that you make a lasting impact on people just by your presence and the actions that you're doing. Everyone is watching you, and they are taking notice. Perhaps you're a little braver than they are, and they didn't have the nerve to show up at a meeting or speak at a rally, but they notice and appreciate those who do. So I really encourage you. You're clearly somebody of strong convictions, and your voice is needed now more than ever.
We're talking with Amy and David Goodman, the co-authors of Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times, on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Along with individual members, businesses and organizations support Wisconsin Public Radio. Corporate support makes up about 10% of WPR's budget. This means higher quality programs for everyone. Thank you, corporate donors, for your continued support.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Catfish River Arts and Antiques in historic downtown Stoughton, featuring quality antique furnishings and works by regional artisans in a restored 1898 department store. Information at catfishriver.com. Jim Packard, along with Amy and David Goodman, as they talk about their book, Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times, had an email from David in Fox Lake. Why has no one even attempted to have an intellectually honest public debate on the morality of the war on terror in the mainstream media? I don't know if you can answer the question, but maybe you have some thoughts about that, Amy.
Well, I mean, it's a key issue, is why hasn't this been taken on? We live in a society that's really made up of two worlds. I mean, you have whole populations that are targeted in the United States, Arab Americans, Muslims, people of South Asian descent. After 9/11, thousands of people have been rounded up. We don't know their names. They don't know the charges against them. Many have been deported. Right now, Professor Sami Alarian, who is a professor from University of South Florida in St. Petersburg, has been imprisoned for more than 5 years. He was brought before a jury. He was tried on 17 counts related to terror. He was not found guilty on one of those counts. He thought he would be getting out this month, but he remains in jail. He's been on a hunger fast, his second now. In his first, he lost close to 50 pounds. His family's deeply concerned about him. One of his daughters, Leila Alarian, writes for The Nation magazine, has just published a book on the war. These are stories that we must learn about, we must know about. Now you've just heard of a reporter, Bilal Hussein. He was a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer for AP. Mm-hmm. He was Iraqi. He was released this week in Iraq by the U.S. forces. He was held for 2 years without charge. These are issues that must be dealt with. Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, CIA black sites, the president now admitting he knew about the high-level meeting within the National Security Council of Condoleezza Rice and the vice president and Rumsfeld, then Secretary of Defense, signing off on essentially torture techniques. This is unprecedented in this country, and it's a discussion that must be had on every network. And it really goes to the issue of who owns our networks. There may be hundreds of channels. What matters is who owns those channels. The FCC just had a hearing yesterday in Stanford University. We were there yesterday in California. We're now in Texas tonight. We're going to Albuquerque, tomorrow to Taos, and then all through Colorado, and then we're going to Salt Lake City, New York, Washington, then through Minneapolis and St. Louis as we continue on our Standing Up to the Madness tour. We are hearing one story after another. Yesterday in Houston, a young man came up to me. He said, "I just came out of detention. I was there for a year. I've been released. I'm okay." I mean, we need to bridge the communities. In one world, we know nothing about what's happening in the other world, and that is the role of the media, to build bridges, not to advocate the bombing of bridges.
Let's take another caller. That would be Ron in Milwaukee. Hello, Ron. Thanks for waiting.
Well, the most targeted group in the United States is organized labor, and we have absolutely no one that we can trust in terms of our presidential candidates this year. We have Barack Obama, who made this absolutely absurd comment about dislocated workers. We have Hillary Clinton now, this comment that's coming out this morning back in 96, where she basically told her husband to screw the workers. And we have John McCain that's had a 34-year hatred with organized labor. And the best thing to do in the 2008 election is to vote for yourself. We have absolutely no one that is going to bring unionized jobs back to this country. We are devastated in the industrial Midwest here. The people are angered. They are to the point of exasperation. And there just isn't any electoral panacea for us.
Well, you know, I think what's interesting, I mean, this, of course, when the issue was raised, I think we know what a hot-button issue this is that you are hitting on because of the whole response we saw when, you know, Barack Obama talks about people being angry and bitter about losing jobs and this kind of thing, and the, you know, the ridiculous backlash, really. And yet, you know, whenever there's a strong backlash, it's always useful to go back to what exactly was said. I mean, the media is an echo chamber, the corporate media, where these you know, little sound bites get replayed again and again and taken out of context. But and not to push Obama over anyone else, but just the point that was being made was the point that you're making. And to speak of the impacts that these trade deals have had, that NAFTA has had, and CAFTA and the other trade deals, this really is the moment to hold these candidates accountable to that. And that's, I think, you know, the role that organized labor has played. It has, you know, far too often gone along to get along with policies that ended up being disastrous for labor. And now we see the importance of simply standing your ground. And where workers' rights are involved, there should not be compromises. We should not be, for political gain, advocating trade deals that result in not only losing American jobs, but disempowering unions.
I agree with that, but Mr. Obama, right after Ohio, had his main aide call up to Canada and say, everything I said in Ohio, I didn't mean. And
well, we don't know if he had him do that, but I think you're raising a critical point, the position of organized labor in this country, and what these politicians would do if they become president of the United States. I mean, with President Clinton, Bill Clinton at the time, strong-arming, pushing Congress into, this was actually a campaign, one of those who led the campaign against NAFTA, if you remember, was Ralph Nader, really fighting hard against Clinton, who was using every trick in the book, particularly offering millions to local Congress members, you know, to give them a bridge to nowhere, anything to get NAFTA passed. Where were the environmental protections? Where were the labor protections? Or rather, why were these deals being pushed through at all? Now we're talking about Colombia, a trade deal with Colombia. This isn't even about free trade. This is corporate-managed trade that is not helping the workers. And when a candidate comes to town, people have to ask them questions. They have to make demands. That's the way the democratic process is supposed to work.
Ron, thank you so much for your expressions this morning and appreciate hearing from you. We're down to the last couple of minutes, and I want to give Amy and David a chance to talk more about their book, Standing Up to the Madness, Ordinary Heroes in Extraordinary Times. And you have a number of situations that are described. We've talked about some of them, the librarians standing up to the request for all of their records. There are others as well. But let me give you a chance to talk why you feel so passionately about this.
Well, one thing I wanted to just be sure to note before we leave you is that you can hear us talk about this in person on April 28th, Monday evening, in Minneapolis, 7 p.m. at the St. Joan of Arc Church. And more details of that stop and others on our tour you can find at democracynow.org. It's really been great talking to people. You know, as Amy mentioned, the young man who came up to us talking about having come out of detention, and many of the stories in this book often began with just meeting people, hearing about a local story. You know, among the other stories we have are the story of New Orleans, where we've spent quite a bit of time looking at how the communities were abandoned in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, and how African-American community activists, recognizing that the federal government had abandoned them, are now trying to not only rebuild, but to fight back and save public housing and make sure that New Orleans continues to be a home for some of its poorest residents who have been not only pushed out, but kept out. Looking at some of the T is for Terrorist is a chapter we have on people who've been arrested just for wearing political T-shirts.
One guy was at the VA having coffee wearing his Veterans for Peace T-shirt, and he was arrested. He was handcuffed because they said that he was protesting simply by wearing that T-shirt. And then, of course, you've got the peace warriors, the soldiers, Agustin Aguayo,
Amy,
the Mexican
you know that there are deadlines for programs.
Southern California, who refused to load his gun.
And we've reached the deadline for this one. I'm sorry, we have to break in, and thank you so much for being with us today. Amy and David Goodman, the book is Standing Up to the Madness. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.